House comes for oral questions. Question number one, Greg O'Connor.
Yes, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What actions has the government taken to support businesses and households to respond to COVID-19?
Speaker. The Honourable Grant Robertson.
The government has taken decisive and considered action to support New Zealand through the COVID-19 pandemic. To date, the wage subsidy scheme has paid out more than $10.6 billion to more than 1.7 million workers. Our $3 billion tax refund scheme put into law last week will start paying out in the coming days to support viable businesses with cash flow and to meet costs like rent. The loss carryback scheme had 161 applications within its very first hours of operating. These measures are being complemented by the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme, which will begin operations next week, the Business Finance Guarantee Scheme, and a range of other measures. All of these measures, Mr Speaker, are designed to keep as many New Zealanders and workers possible and cushion the blow on households and businesses.
Supplementary question. What recent reports has he seen on employment in New Zealand?
Mr Speaker, Statistics New Zealand today reported the number of employed people rose by 19,000 in the March quarter, while the number of unemployed was up by 5,000. The employment rate rose to 67.5%, while the unemployment rate also rose slightly from 4 to 4.2%, remaining near its lowest levels in a decade. The fact, Mr Speaker, that nearly 20,000 New Zealanders entered work in the first 3 months of this year shows the economy's underlying strength heading into the COVID-19 pandemic. Wages were also rising at an annual rate of 3.6%, Mr Speaker, with average ordinary time hourly earnings up $33.14. Mr Speaker, all of these things reflect the position New Zealand was in before the worst of COVID-19. It was a strong position and it will enable New Zealand to come through this crisis well.
Further supplementary, what reports has he seen on the economic recovery post-COVID-19?
Speaker, bank economists are forecasting a more rapid economic recovery post-COVID-19 than the global financial crisis. They anticipate 4 years of above 5% unemployment, whereas after the GFC there were 8. Westpac has said that countries that have had early success in containing the virus, like New Zealand, China, South Korea and Australia, are likely to see a quicker rebound. This faster rebound backs our decision that the best economic response was a public health response. As we've said all along, we will get through this together.
Question number two, the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all her government's statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, yes. Particularly the government's work to prevent and respond to COVID-19, including in more recent times the work that Prime Minister Morrison and I and the Foreign Minister, the Honourable Winston Peters and Maurice Payne, are undertaking on a Trans-Tasman COVID-safe travel zone as soon as it is safe to do so. A Trans-Tasman COVID-safe travel zone would be mutually beneficial, assisting our trade and economic recovery, helping kickstart tourism and transport sectors, enhancing sporting contacts and reuniting family and friends. This arrangement recognises that Australia and New Zealand are working hard to successfully address the spread of COVID-19. The global pandemic is hitting every nation, and we are moving to cushion the blow for businesses and workers in this country as fast as we can safely do so.
Stand by her government's decision to have a more extreme economic lockdown than Australia, given the comment from Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who she's referred to, that the health outcome in Australia, or health outcomes, I should say, in Australia are, quote, on a per capita basis, actually better.
Mr Speaker, I'd point out, and I know this because I have this conversation with Prime Minister Morrison, he is often asked questions comparing the favourable results in New Zealand relative to Australia in the same way that the Leader of the Opposition attempts to do to me. So, Mr Speaker, I'd point out that the context of those questions are often because in Australia they perceive New Zealand to have done well, something I know the Member of the Opposition is not keen to acknowledge.
So does she agree when Scott Morrison says that the health outcomes in Australia are, quote, on a per capita basis, actually better?
Speaker, I would point out today there have been 33 cases across three states in Australia. I wish our counterparts in Australia only the best. It is in both our interests that we successfully win the battle against this virus. But as we're all experiencing, managing the tail at this point, when we're trying to get ourselves in a position to get back to some normality, is not easy, as Australia is experiencing, and I hope that we don't.
Does she agree with Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison that, quote, just having a low number of cases is not a success, particularly when you have a lot of people out of work?
Again, Mr. Speaker, I point out that often some of those answers are prefaced on the fact that people are pushing for low number of cases, because that is one of the best ways that we can successfully get ourselves back to the situation of relative normality. And that is our goal in New Zealand. What we need, Mr. Speaker, and I know this is not a position the Leader of the Opposition necessarily agrees with, but we do not need at this time to roll the dice. We do not need to risk all of the gains that we have only just begun to make. We need steady, predictable progress, because that will provide the best groundwork for an economic recovery that we possibly can.
Does she accept that having a low number of cases isn't success if you've got exponentially rising unemployment?
What will make unemployment worse is yo-yoing back and forth in your response, because that loses the predictability that the business community wants and needs. I will not roll the dice and risk losing the gains New Zealanders have only just made. We need to make predictable, balanced progress, and that is what we are focused on as a government. Mr. Speaker, I always also point out that the member is not quick to make all of the comparisons with Australia. Australia's parliament has been suspended to August, not something we would do here, so not every comparison is a favourable one.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, in light of the supplementary questions that have come before, can the Prime Minister confirm that as at the 24th of April, an additional 500,000 people had gone on to unemployment assistance in Australia?
Yes, and another point that I'll make is, of course, we moved very quickly to get support to employers to support their employees. My understanding is that no cash has been paid yet for their equivalent of a wage subsidy, something that we moved very, very quickly on.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Can I ask the Prime Minister, is it her view that if you were to multiply by 5 our 2 of today, as against the 33 in Australia, that would be a very sad and unfavourable comparison, and rather than gloating, we should sympathise with the Australian people?
Exactly right, Mr. Speaker. The point that we're making here is that we want both sides of the Tasman to do well, and they are grappling with a small number of outbreaks.
Order. Ask Prime Minister Dan. I am getting sick of the Leader of the Opposition trying to shout down the Prime Minister. I'm trying to listen to her answer, and it's getting difficult.
Okay. As I was saying, they're dealing with a small number of outbreaks, but it points to the vulnerability that we're all in as we try to balance that exit out of the restrictions that both countries have had. As I say, we've been working hard to share advice and information, because we want only the best for our trans-Tasman cousins and success for both of us.
How many people does the government expect to lose their job this year?
Mr. Speaker, there has been a wide number of predictions, the best of which has been unemployment reaching under just one of the scenarios for Treasury around 8.5%, but of course it could be higher than that. All of it depends on the amount of investment we're successfully able to make to support people into work, to ensure we have good job creation, and to support those who may have lost their incomes.
Are reports correct? The Ministry of Social Development are currently preparing for an additional 300,000 people to apply for the unemployment benefit this year.
Mr. Speaker, of course you would expect our Social Development Agency to prepare for unemployment and people seeking job seeker. What we have also been doing, though, is not just preparing for that, but trying to work to prevent it. The wage subsidy is being specifically designed to try and support people to stay connected to their workforce so they don't need to enter into an unemployment benefit. In terms of the most recent numbers for social development support, my recollection for the member is that in the last week it increased by about 6,000 and the previous week it was about 9,000.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Can the Prime Minister confirm that increases of up to 288,000 people on a benefit would be possible under one of Treasury's more severe economic scenarios that they released on the 13th of April, and that the Government has dismissed that scenario on the basis that we intend to provide more support than the scenario is based on?
Mr. Speaker, yes, keeping in mind, the member would do well to keep in mind that some of the Treasury economic modelling included, for instance, a scenario where New Zealand would be in a form of lockdown for a year. Obviously, that is not something that we have entertained, and we have worked very hard to go hard, go early, and get us back to normality in a with as little risk as possible.
Order, order, order. The Leader of the House should know better than to wind up the Leader of the Opposition.
Why isn't the government focused on saving jobs instead of preparing for them to go into the dole?
Mr. Speaker, the precise reason that we designed the wage subsidy and brought it into effect before we even had a lockdown in New Zealand was for the very reason that we wanted people to keep their connection to work. That is also why we designed it to be paid out through an employer rather than, for instance, the Ministry of Social Development. It was because we were focused on keeping people in work. It's also why we designed a package that had elements to it like tax refunds. It's also why we created a redeployment fund. It's all been about keeping people in the dignity and security of work.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Can I ask the Prime Minister, contrary to former times, is she saying that Treasury is not running the country anymore, but the people of New Zealand through the elected representatives, are?
Mr. Speaker, obviously we provided advice, obviously in these cases we provided a range of scenarios, but I think what we also have to acknowledge, and Treasury would acknowledge this too, these are very uncertain times. That's why they created a range of scenarios, and of course we would do well as a government to make sure we prepare, but also do everything in our power to keep people in work. We are, for instance, as one party in this coalition government, called the Labour Party.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Which scenario is likely to result in the greatest number of job losses? Getting it right the first time or rushing an end to the lockdown and having to go back into lockdown because there are further outbreaks?
Speaker, getting it right the first time, and you'll see that we've been very clear every time that the reason we have taken a balanced approach rather than taking risks is because of that very fact. And that's something that's been reinforced by the likes of Treasury and the advice that they have provided. Again, Mr. Speaker, I point out to the member that some of the worst scenarios produced by Treasury are those that have us in long periods of lockdown because of loss of control. That results in unemployment rates as high as 17.5%. No one wants that.
The reality that today, in fact, the Prime Minister's wrong, and it's 25, not... It's 33, I think she said, cases in Australia.
Okay, my reference was to just three states.
Does she accept that every day we remain in lockdown, more businesses will collapse and more people will lose their jobs?
Mr. Speaker, even more businesses will collapse and even more businesses will lose their jobs if we roll the dice and take risks against gains that we have only just made. Mr. Speaker, the mere suggestion from that member that we are not mindful of people's lives and livelihoods is just wrong. Everything we do factors in the impact of our decision on them. But I will not gamble their jobs by taking risky, knee-jerk decisions that don't protect their long-term futures.
Question number three, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question to the Minister of Finance, what is the Treasury's most recent estimate of changes to the unemployment rate over the next 6 months? And based on that estimate, what is the expected fiscal impact?
Speaker. The Treasury's most recent estimates of changes to the unemployment rate over the next 6 months were contained in the scenarios published on April 14th. The Treasury will provide their official forecasts in the Budget, Economic and Fiscal Update next week. The current unemployment rate is 4.2%. In response to the second part of the member's question, the fiscal impact will be determined by the government's actions and investments to support businesses, create jobs and support those who are looking for work. The next set of fiscal forecasts will also be published in the Budget next week.
Supplementary, what advice has he received on the impact in terms of jobs, of every extra week we remain in level three?
Mr. Speaker, again, that material is contained in the Treasury's scenarios and can be extrapolated out from the overall output loss that the Treasury simulated in those exercises. Obviously, the full data and full estimates of the Treasury that we would regard as forecasts and that we would regard as official will be contained in next week's budget.
How does he weigh the certainty of more job losses each week we extend heavy lockdown restrictions against the possibility of job losses in the future if our health measures fail to control another outbreak and we have to yo-yo back into lockdown?
Mr. Speaker, again, if you take a look at the Treasury's scenarios, which predicted a different amount of time spent at different levels, it shows you the severity of the impact. And, Mr. Speaker, I think it's very clear to New Zealanders who worked extremely hard to get through level four just how strict the lockdown measures are. We can now see in level three that output is returning and forecast to be around 75%. Mr. Speaker, clearly, if we have to move back into levels three and four once we get to level two, that will constrain economic activity significantly.
Point of order, I don't mean to be tough, but he said a lot, but I don't think he at all addressed the issue of how does he weigh the certainty of one thing against the possibility of another.
Well, a bit more of the member. Well, I thought he did, but I'll go with the member. I'm being flexible.
Mr. Speaker, the point that I was making is that the scenario, one example of how to weigh it up, is to look at the scenarios and see the different amount of time that the country would be forecast to spend there and what that would mean for output, as I said in my earlier answer. Mr. Speaker, if the point that the member is getting to is it a difficult decision for the government to be able to put in place the restrictions that we did? Of course it is. But we are very clear, and we can go back as far, if the member, who I know has an interest in history, would like to go back to the 1918 flu epidemic and look at the studies that have been done by American economists that show that the states in America who went hard and early and did it once and did it right came back economically from there far better than the states who, for instance, went out of lockdown too early and then had to go back.
Isn't it true that waiting for certainty and refusing to roll the dice, as the Prime Minister says, about the future costs real jobs now?
Speaker, from the very first day when I stood up in this House and announced our $12 billion package on the 17th of March, we acknowledged, as every government around the world has to acknowledge, that there will be job losses as a result of a 1-in-100-year health and economic shock. What New Zealand has managed to do together is ensure that we are getting the best possible result for our health status and for our economy. I remind the member, 500,000 people have been added to unemployment queues in Australia.
What makes him confident that loading small businesses with more debt will save jobs?
Mr. Speaker, the reaction I've had from a number of small businesses and from those who advocate on their behalf, who have been very pleased indeed to see a scheme that gets the balance right to be making sure that viable businesses are in a position to be able to get the money that they need.
Does he share MSD's expectation that 300,000 New Zealanders will lose their job this year?
Mr. Speaker, that's not MSD's expectation. What MSD was doing was planning something that I think members opposite would ask government agencies to do. Planning in that case, using some data, I think it's under 300, I think it's 288,000, which was based on one of the more pessimistic scenarios. The good news is, Mr. Speaker, that the government has already put in place more fiscal stimulus than was connected to that particular scenario.
Question number four, Marama Davidson.
My question is to the Minister of Health. How has the government engaged with the Māori health sector during the COVID-19 pandemic?
The Honourable Dr David Clark.
Mr Speaker, the government recognised that if we did not develop a specific response for Māori, that Māori were likely to carry a higher health burden as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. That is why we provided an initial funding support package of $56 million to support Māori to develop responses that worked for Māori communities. The government has worked extensively across the Māori health sector to design, develop, support and implement the Māori health response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Central to the government's response has been the development of the COVID-19 Māori Response Action Plan, which was developed in conjunction with the COVID-19 Māori Reference Group, Tumu Whakaere, and the Technical Advisory Group.
What evidence has he seen of Māori health organisations delivering valuable services to keep their communities well during the pandemic?
Mr Speaker, the Ministry worked closely with Tumu Whakaere to identify strong providers in the Māori health network who showed that they could effectively support the COVID-19 response. Māori health providers have been working quickly and innovatively throughout the pandemic to keep their communities safe. Papakura Marae in South Auckland and Ngāhau e Whā Marae in Christchurch, for example, have established community-based assessment centres at their marae to support whānau and improve access to healthcare. And we know that Māori have responded well to the CBACs at marae. The Ministry has also contributed funding to support whānau order commissioning agencies to respond quickly to COVID-19. With this funding, commissioning agencies and their national networks of health and social service providers across the motu have ensured the provision of health and hygiene packs, care packages, information and other forms of necessary and holistic support to whānau. These are a few examples only of how Māori health providers have been working to support their communities.
How has Māori health equity been considered at each stage of the COVID response?
Well, equity for Māori is a critical feature of the Ministry's COVID-19 response, and we are ensuring it is considered at every stage of the pandemic. One of the Ministry's first steps was to introduce a proactive influenza vaccination program with a specific focus on Kaumātua and Kuia. This was launched in mid-March to target vulnerable groups, including Māori. The program has been successful, with twice the amount of Kaumātua and Kuia receiving their flu vaccinations compared to previous years. I'd also note that the Cancer Control Agency has recently appointed an equity director. In the context of the pandemic, the agency has developed treatment guidelines for medical oncology, radio-oncology, haematology, cancer surgery and cancer radiology. The Cancer Control Agency is also looking at the non-treatment drivers of cancer inequities to identify what other resources or supports might be required to maximise access to cancer treatment and care.
What role does he see in bringing Māori health experts to the decision-making table after the pandemic?
Mr Speaker, the Ministry worked with the Māori Reference Group to develop Whakamoa, the draft Māori Action Health Action Plan, and that group was established last year. The Ministry has worked with them throughout the pandemic and will continue to work with them in future to ensure our work is suitable, relevant for whānau and fit for purpose. Māori health experts have also been brought on to the Technical Advisory Group and other advisory boards. The Ministry of Health have also worked with the National Iwi Chairs Forum, Māori Funeral Directors, Funeral Directors Association of New Zealand, New Zealand Mortuary Services Limited, Māori Reference Group, Technical Advisory Group, Tumu Whakaere. I see their role as a means to ensure equity is a core part of our business.
What progress has the government made in implementing the recommendations of the Waitangi Tribunal's 2019 Ho-Water Report, such as strengthening equity in the health system?
Cabinet has agreed to accept the Tribunal findings for Stage 1 of the Y2575 Health Services and Outcomes Kaupapa Inquiry, as the findings are largely reflective of Crown witnesses' evidence provided to date. The Ministry has entered into a heads of agreement with Stage 1 claimants to progress some of the recommendations in the Ho Order report. The operational recommendations in the whole order report align with work the Ministry has already committed to and already has underway. The Ministry will continue to progress the operational recommendations that can be achieved quickly using existing levers and within current baselines.
Question number five, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and asks, can she confirm reports that the Ministry of Social Development is preparing for a further 300,000 benefit applications?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister for Social Development, I'm advised that MSD is planning for a wide range of scenarios to ensure that those who need help in these extraordinary times can get it. Increases of up to 288,000 would be possible under one of Treasury's more severe economic scenarios released on the 13th of April. That scenario has already been dismissed by the government, and that is not what MSD is currently planning for.
How many of the 300,000 new benefit applications will be for job seeker support?
Oh. My first question.
Yes.
Does she accept that if we reach an unemployment rate of 13.5%, which is Treasury's best case scenario, that we will have nearly 500,000 people on JobSeeker alone?
Order. I'm going to ask the member to ask the question again. I think there was an assertion in that question which even I know is wrong.
Does she accept if we reach an unemployment rate of 13.5% as the Treasury has forecast under its best case scenario, it is nearly twice the figure that the Minister quoted earlier?
I reject the assertion in the member's question.
What action is she now taking to prepare MSD to support 500,000 Kiwis getting back to work?
Mr. Speaker, the government is engaged in a very comprehensive program across government to ensure that there are opportunities available for people who find themselves out of work, both to provide them with immediate financial support where they need it, to provide retraining opportunities where those are needed, and to ensure that they can get back into work as quickly as possible. There is a whole range of initiatives. I could spend a few hours outlining them all for the member if she'd like.
What advice has she received, if any, on the health and social impacts of 500,000 Kiwis requiring the unemployment benefit?
Mr. Speaker, the government is doing everything it can possible to avoid that scenario.
Question number six, Kira Tapu Allen.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister for the Environment. What action is the government taking?
Look, I think that's the fourth time. Sorry, wasn't the member who? Oh, sorry, it was Mr. Maybe the member's getting the blame. I apologise to Simon Bridges for looking at him for the interruption that Mr. Goldsmith has made. But maybe it's infectious. A point of order.
This is a genuine point of order. Yeah. You have suspended the reduction of supplementary questions.
No, I haven't. I've just been softer.
Right.
Okay. All right. The member does tempt fate. Kira Tapu Allen.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister for the Environment. What action is the government taking to support employment following the COVID-19 epidemic?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable David Parker.
An important element of this government's COVID-19 rebuild plan is a law change to fast-track eligible projects under the Resource Management Act to help get New Zealand moving again. The primary purpose of the plan is to bring forward employment opportunities. We went hard and early to beat the virus, and now we're doing the same to get the economy moving too. The success of our health response gives us a head start on the world, and this fast-tracking process will enable our economic recovery to follow. The new processes will get consents or get projects started sooner and people into jobs faster, but part two of the RMA will still be applied to protect the environment.
Supplementary, sir. What sorts of projects will the legislation support to get up and running quickly?
Mr Speaker, we want to spread new employment opportunities throughout the country in a wide range of projects. Projects which could benefit from quicker consenting include roading, walking and cycling, rail, housing, sediment removal from silted rivers and estuaries, new wetland construction, flood management works and projects to prevent landfill erosion.
Thank you, sir. What safeguards will be in the legislation?
The primary purpose of the plan is to assist New Zealanders to obtain employment as we recover from the economic impacts of COVID-19. We're helping by getting projects up and running, but also ensuring that Part 2 of the RMA continues to apply and that treaty obligations, national directions and district plans are also upheld. As Minister for the Environment, I will filter projects through to an expert panel, that panel will in general approve projects and in all situations will set conditions to ensure environmental standards are implied. The panel will have a cross-section of expertise required to make decisions quickly. It will be chaired by a current or former Environment Court judge. There will be the opportunity for some written input, as applications will be shared with a named group of NGOs from a range of sectors, and that will be done as applications are put to the panel.
Question number 7, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr Speaker, to the Minister for the Environment. Does he stand by all his statements on the fast-tracking of shovel-ready projects?
Speaker.
Yes, in the context they were given.
How many of the reported 1,800 shovel-ready projects are already fully consented and funded?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I don't envisage that 1,800 projects would be going through this process anyway.
When will he release the criteria for which shovel-ready projects will enter the fast-track resource consenting process?
Mr Speaker, at a high level, that will be set out in the legislation, which I expect to be introduced into the House in the coming weeks, and which I will endeavour to share with the opposition in advance of its introduction.
Will the fast-tracked shovel-ready projects need to meet the requirements of the Zero Carbon Act?
The decision that I have as to which projects go to this panel will include consideration of what could be long-term significant effects on carbon emissions. So if, for example, there was a proposal to build a new coal-fired mine, a new coal-fired power station, which I think was unlikely, but if that did happen, then I would take that into account in my decision as to whether I would let that go to a panel, and in that sort of situation, I might choose to send it to through a normal Environment Court process or a normal Council Environment Court process instead.
Do ready-to-go projects or shovel-ready projects mean that shovels are now ready to be put into the ground?
I would have expected the member would have known a metaphor when she heard it. There's actually not many people do roading projects with shovels, but she can keep digging.
Marma Davidson.
How will he ensure environmental protection is sustained for any projects that are fast-tracked?
Mr Speaker, in a number of ways. One, there will be a range of projects brought forward. I'm quite keen on the idea that we take this opportunity to start remediating some of the environmental damage we already have in New Zealand. So, for example, one of the ways we could achieve balance is by consenting in a high-level way projects to excavate sediments from polluted rivers and estuaries, and to consent the installation of new wetlands to prevent those sediments reoccurring. Another way that we ensure appropriate environmental outcomes is to have it chaired by an Environment Court judge and to apply Part 2 of the RMA.
Does he agree then that it's possible to create good jobs and protect nature at the same time?
Yes, those two things are not always mutually exclusive. It is true that some projects do have an adverse environmental effect that can't be fully mitigated, but we're endeavouring to get the balance right between traditional projects like roading, for example, and projects to improve the environment.
And how will the government ensure tangata whenua are involved and the Crown's Te Tiriti o Waitangi objections are upheld in any decision-making to fast-track projects?
The legislation won't be abrogating the outcomes of treaty settlements, and one of the ways in which we will be ensuring those interests are taken into account is ensuring that the panel has relevant expertise when those issues are considered by them.
Question number 8, Chris Bishop. A point of order, the Honourable Gerry Brown.
Mr Speaker, sorry to... I was just so engrossed in the answer we got before. Each week, under these different circumstances, the government has provided a list of ministers to the opposition in order that we might be able to more appropriately organise our questions to ministers each week. This week, the two transport ministers, associate ministers, transport minister has not been here. The two transport minister associates were due to be here today. That was the information we got, and we've organised our questions accordingly. Now, I know we don't speak about members not being present, but all I can say is that it would not be possible for an associate transport minister, let alone the transport minister, to answer the question today as we would have expected, taking the advice from the government as to who would be here today.
Sure. Speaking of point of order, Chris.
Mr Speaker, I have supplied the opposition with a list of ministers who will be available at question time each day, and I have indicated to the opposition that where they ask questions to ministers who are not present, or to portfolios where the minister that holds the portfolio is not present, that we will ensure that there is a minister fully briefed and able to answer questions on their behalf.
I just want to check first of all, was Mr Twyford's name on the list supplied for ministers to be present today? It wasn't. Okay, thank you.
Speaking to the point of order first.
No, if Karen.
Well, look, I'm not going to dispute the fact that you do. You have followed that process. All I'm saying is that there is an issue that this question relates to that has come to light this week. And it would have been reasonable, I think, it is reasonable for us to assume that we look at your list and say, who are the associates? We knew that Mr. Twyford wasn't going to be here. There were two associates set down to be here today. We can't ask the question and have it answered by one of those associates today. So I think we need to have a slightly better process. Hopefully, we're only going to be carrying on with this for another 2 days, but you know, at this stage, we don't know.
No, I'm going to deal with it now. The standing orders are very clear, and that is that any minister may answer on any other minister's behalf, and there is no obligation, if an associate minister is present, for that person to be answering for the minister who is absent.
That is not my point. My point is that we are sitting here by agreement in a house structured in a way that does not meet the requirements of standing orders. We've set those aside. We've set aside the proxies. We have an arrangement where, to give some validity to the question time, we're told what ministers are going to be here. I'm simply pointing out that we're extremely disappointed that the government has not been able to get the two associates here, one of whom might have answered for Mr Twyford, who we always knew was not going to be here.
The member has recorded his disappointment, but I will reiterate my comment, and that is that while it might be his preference that an associate minister answer a question for an absent minister, it is not a requirement of the standing orders, and it is not a practice of the House on all occasions. Mr Hipkins. Or Mr Bishop.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Question to the Minister of Transport. When is the Transmission Gully project expected to be completed and open to the public? And did the New Zealand Transport Agency receive legal advice that advised the agency not to provide $190.6 million of financial relief to CPBHEBJV, which it agreed to do in February 2020?
The Honourable Chris Hipkin.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Transport, the New Zealand Transport Agency assures me that they are committed to seeing the Transmission Gully project completed as quickly as possible. They're currently working with the builder to confirm and agree a new completion date. Without waiving legal privilege in the advice that the New Zealand Transport Agency received prior to its settlement with the JV, they have confirmed that they did not receive legal advice that it should not provide $190.6 million of financial relief.
Why has the five-week lockdown period ostensibly caused months or even years of delay to the opening of Transmission Gully?
Mr Speaker, as I indicated in my primary answer, the extent of the delay has not yet been determined, and NZTA is currently negotiating a new completion date with the builder. But it is important to note that seasonal factors do come into play here, and that different parts of the road can be completed at different times of the year.
Was the board of the Transport Agency advised to enter into litigation against the contractor for Transmission Gully rather than settle?
Mr Speaker, I am not privy to the legal advice that the New Zealand Transport Agency Board has received, and they have not waived legal privilege. I was able to get confirmation from them to answer the primary question, but if the member wants to have something more specific about the legal advice the Board has received, then he would be best advised to put down a more specific question.
Why did the Transport Agency settle with the contractor for Transmission Gully?
Mr Speaker, the New Zealand Transport Agency wants to get the roading project finished.
Will the Transport Agency enforce the penalty clauses in the contract with the Wellington Gateway Partnership for late delivery of Transmission Gully?
Mr Speaker, it is not the habit of the Minister or the New Zealand Transport Agency to undertake commercial negotiations through question time.
Supplementary. Is he confident that the wholesale changes to the Transport Agency board and management in 2018 and 2019 have had no impact on the ability of the Transport Agency to manage the risks associated with the Transmission Gully project?
Mr Speaker, yes.
Question number nine, Kieran McInulty.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Commerce and Consumer Affairs, how is the government protecting consumers who need access to credit?
The Honourable Chris Farfoy.
Mr Speaker, the government has fast-tracked measures to protect people experiencing financial hardship from high-cost loans that can trap them in debt. These measures include the cap on interest and fees to a maximum equivalent to the principal of a loan, known as the 100% cap, the prohibition of compound interest on high-cost loans, and the $30 limit on default fees. These measures were originally due to come into force on June 1, but were moved to the 1st of May in urgent legislation last week. Some may think that that's only a month, but it's obvious many Kiwi families will be going through difficult conversations and decisions about their finances right now, and if they're looking to borrow, the government wanted them to have the full protection of our planned regime in order to ensure safe borrowing.
Supplementary. Why was it important to fast-track these changes?
Mr Speaker, these are obviously very difficult and financially stressful times for many families around New Zealand. If people need to take out any new loans from high-cost lenders, the changes we have fast-tracked make sure they are protected from getting trapped in debt spirals. While it was critical to make these changes, I urge anyone facing financial difficulties to explore options before taking on any high-cost loans. They can talk with their lender about alternative payment arrangements, contact Work and Income for financial assistance, or get in touch with their local budgeting service for advice.
Entry. When will the rest of the government's consumer credit reforms take effect?
Mr Speaker, on account of the disruption for lenders and their customers because of COVID-19, we have allowed for the broader system of changes to commence 6 months after the date that it was originally planned. So the new date is now the 1st of October 2021. These include significant reforms relating to all lenders, such as new affordability regulations, certification of directors as fit and proper persons, and directors' duties.
Question number 10, the Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Justice. Does he stand by his statement yesterday regarding his legislation to extend prisoner voting rights being considered during a national emergency that the Select Committee timetable, quote, is not a matter over which I have any control?
Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I refer the member to my full statement, which was the bill to which the member refers is in the hands of the Justice Committee. It is not a matter over which I have any control. It is a bill that is in the control of the Select Committee.
Supplementary, did he move a motion in this Parliament to reduce the Select Committee timetable on the prisoner voting bill from the normal 6 months to less than 3 months, most of which has been in lockdown?
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Did he write to the Justice Select Committee on the 31st of March saying the prisoner voting bill needed to be progressed as quickly as possible under the national emergency, but also stating that his just officials, and I quote, will not...
A point of order, Greg O'Connor.
Speaker, I'm a member of the Justice Select Committee, and the letter to which the member is referring is in the business of the committee. And as a diligent member of that committee, I am unaware of any motion or any instruction from the chairman that has been released. Just seeking your guidance as to whether reference to that letter is able to be done in this House.
Well, I'm looking at the date of the letter, which is the 31st. I have it in front of me. The 31st of March, and on the basis that it's been received by the committee, that's been minuted. Unless it was part of a confidential part of the business, I don't think there's a problem at this stage with it being referred to. If it is something which was, you know, at a very recent meeting, and there hadn't been a subsequent meeting, and minutes hadn't been issued, then that might be the case. Dr. Smith, as the third most experienced parliamentarian, might want to indicate to the House. I'm always not here, so it doesn't really matter. Might want to indicate to the House that he's not breaching any committee confidentiality with it.
Clerk has noted the matter has been referred to publicly and was not subject. The clerk of the committee.
Thank you. Right.
Can I restate my question now that the flow has been lost? Did he write to the Justice Select Committee on the 31st of March saying the prisoner voting bill needed to be progressed as quickly as possible under the national emergency, but also stated that his justice officials, and I quote, will not be able to assist on the sexual violence legislation requiring extension of the report back date on that bill to 14th June?
Mr. Speaker, no.
Supplementary, will the Minister, with the Government's commitment to be the most open and transparent ever, and under this extraordinary national emergency, publicly release his letter dated the 31st of March, saying that the prisoner voting bill was
order.
A priority.
What I'm going to do is going to ask the member to start again to ask a question. There are at least two clauses in the beginning of that question which were superfluous. Start again.
Will the minister publicly release his letter dated the 31st of March saying the prisoner voting bill
order.
Was the government priority,
order.
But the sexual
order.
Violence legislation was not?
Mr. Speaker, I have not written a letter with those words in it.
Why? Will the Minister release his letter to the Justice Select Committee dated the 31st of March about the government's legislative priorities?
Mr Speaker, as I understand it, that letter is a letter to the committee, and it is a matter for that committee to determine what it wishes to do with the letter.
Supplementary.
A point of order, Greg O'Connor.
Mr Speaker, the Dr Smith referred to such a letter having been publicly discussed. The only person who ever brought that to the public was Dr Smith. Mr Speaker,
order. Doctor, both of you sit down. Dr Smith will withdraw and apologise for interjecting during a point of order. Sorry, who did it? Who said, well, there you go? Who made that comment?
I withdraw and apologise.
Right, I'm clearly having some directional things here. It's probably even for the one that I didn't blame you for.
Can I briefly speak to the point of order, Mr Speaker?
No. Greg O'Connor is partway through a point of order.
Yes, Mr Speaker, I refer to, again, I remind the Speaker, this has not been released by the committee, and I know the Speaker has ruled on that. What I do point the Speaker to is that Dr Smith has mentioned that it already has been discussed publicly. The only person who brought that to the public was Dr Smith. I think
I've heard enough. I sought and received an assurance as to the public nature of this from Dr Smith. I have relied on that, and I'm not going to have a member now doubt the word of a member which has been given to the House.
Supplementary. Why is the government, at a time when millions of law-abiding New Zealanders are not being allowed to leave their homes or go to work or open their businesses, making a priority of legislation to give prisoners the vote?
Mr Speaker, the progress of that bill is a matter entirely in the hands of the Select Committee.
Point of order, Mr Speaker.
A point of order, the Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
I seek leave of the House for the report back timetable for the Electoral Registration of Centred Prisoners Bill to be extended by the period of the national lockdown to the 7th of July 2020.
Is there any objection to that occurring?
Yes, yes.
There is. Question number 11, the Honourable Jackie Dean.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Local Government. Does she stand by all her government's policies and statements?
The Honourable Nanaia Mohuta.
Yes, in the context and the spirit in which the statement was made.
Does she agree that each council should be able to set their annual rates over their own assets after consultation with their communities?
Mr Speaker, I've advised councils that they should think very carefully and consider all the information about revenue as a result of the COVID-19 situation, revenue projected forecast for the 2020-21 period before making decisions around rates.
Does she agree with her ministerial colleague Phil Twyford, who said about joint infrastructure projects, quote, "If councils cut their rates, I will not be able to advocate for us to make up the difference and bail you out," unquote.
Mr Speaker, I do agree with the fact that Minister Twyford has clearly been setting out the case for opportunity around infrastructure partnerships with local councils, but they would need to think very carefully about the forecast revenue for the 2020-21 period and before they consider cutting rates or having zero rates. But just to highlight the issue. The forecast revenue in 2018 to 2028 through LTPs was for the 2020-21 year was approximately $15.5 billion. However, as a result of COVID-19, the forecast reduction is currently projected to be between 2.3% to 11%, which equates to $355 million, or $1.5 billion loss in revenue to local government. If they want successful partnerships, we suggest as a government that they consider all the information before cutting rates or holding them, freezing them at zero.
Does she agree with Hamilton Mayor Paula Southgate, who said, quote, if we want the government to stand beside us and bring their money to our table to benefit our community, we must invest alongside them because that's only fair and reasonable, unquote.
I certainly heard that statement and agree with her sentiment because there is a strong ambition in the Waikato for a partnership to continue. She also said that the challenge for councils was a balancing act and they needed to consider carefully what they were doing in relation to rates decisions.
Is it a priority for the Minister to take the views of local government into account when developing policy?
It certainly is a priority, and I want to thank the local government sector for working with us during this COVID period in setting up a response unit made up of Local Government New Zealand and SOLGAM in order to respond in an agile way to the everyday issues that councils were facing as they were working their way through this particular period. I also want to thank the CDEM response and the essential workers who have made sure that things have continued to happen while councils are dealing with the forecast challenges that are coming up during the recovery period.
Question number 12, Greg O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. What public health measures have contributed to the decline in new cases of COVID-19?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, collectively New Zealanders have done an outstanding job to bring COVID-19 under control. In the last week, there have been just 14 new confirmed and probable cases identified. There are a range of factors that have driven our success, but key among them is the response of all New Zealanders to the restrictions placed on them as part of the alert level system. The lockdown, use of physical distancing and people staying within their bubbles have resulted in New Zealand managing to stop community transmission of COVID-19 for now. Our challenge is to maintain that as we see more parts of the economy open up and more people moving about in the community. Ongoing high levels of testing and effective contact tracing will continue to be key elements of our strategy.
Supplementary question, how is testing for COVID-19 progressing?
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand has capacity to process more than 8,600 tests per day and has completed more than 160,000 tests. As at 2 May, for every 1,000 people in New Zealand, we have conducted 30 tests, the same rate as Germany and more than Singapore, the United Kingdom and South Korea. Testing rates for Māori and Pacific peoples remain high. The latest data I have shows Māori make up 16.1% of tests and Pacific 8.2%. DHBs are also identifying higher risk populations such as healthcare workers and border staff for targeted testing.
Further supplementary, how important is it for the public to continue to observe the rules of COVID-19 level 3?
Mr. Speaker, as encouraging as our progress is, we can't afford to take anything for granted. We need everyone to continue to play their part. Stick to your bubble, observe physical distancing and good hygiene practices, stay home if you are sick, and if you have any symptoms of COVID-19, seek medical advice and get tested. Mr. Speaker, I want to thank the public once again for their collective efforts and their commitment to stamping out this virus and by doing so, saving lives.
That concludes oral questions.